the other thing that we've been talking about recently is the role of nutrition in this patient group. They've got, by definition, they've got type 1 intestinal failure. The gut can't do its job. Mm-hmm. Nice guidance, the clinical guideline 32 to say that you should think about supporting people with parenteral nutrition if they can't eat or drink or are unlikely to be able to eat or drink for 5 days or more. It's based on poor evidence. But in all the models we did from NASBO, malnutrition was associated with worse outcomes, both in terms of mortality and major complications. So it's something that's been bumped up the agenda recently. So I'd also say if you're thinking about anyone you've got with small bowel obstruction, particularly adhesional, you need to think about what do I need to do for this person nutritionally as well, because we could be here for 2 weeks before someone thinks about it.
That is a change of practice, and getting a nutrition team, but convincing them that it is important is quite difficult, because of course it brings its own complications as well. So obviously somebody like you will be thinking about this from day one when they come in. Who do you get the nutrition team to see and put a line into and then give TPN, and when does that happen?
Oh, that's actually a very difficult question. So everyone who's admitted to an acute hospital should be having a malnutrition risk score done. And we use the MUST score in the UK, the Malnutrition Universal Screening Tool, which basically looks at your current BMI, and I think you score the most points if you've got a BMI of less than 20. You score if you've had some weight loss in the last couple of months, and you get bonus points if you have a condition that means you're unlikely to eat or drink for the next few days. Now, this is often done by the least experienced member of the nursing or nursing support team, or someone who doesn't fully appreciate the disease that they're looking after. By definition, all people with small bowel obstruction are, you know, they are at risk of not eating or drinking for a few days, so they should qualify as high risk on MUST. There are no other tools really that help stratify, say, you know, this person's going to be longer without food or drink than another person. I would suggest that people, we know in practice that the people who get nutrition support are the ones who end up needing surgery within 24 hours. They're usually people who've got really bad ischemia, and the reason they get their parenteral nutrition within 24 hours is because they go to intensive care, and it makes people feel like they're doing something extra if they can, you know, provide parenteral nutrition. Whereas a person who's sat on the ward, they've not necessarily got that high acuity team around who are thinking about all these things. I think for me, if I was considering managing an adhesive obstruction conservatively, that is a group of people where I'd be talking to my nutrition team and saying, you know, this is someone I'd like to have on the radar. Shall we do all the bloods and make sure the micronutrients are sorted? Think about doing Papranex. And then if the gastrographin challenge doesn't look like a resolution, then maybe we should be getting a pick line and supporting this person with nutrition. But that is not an exact science. That's quite emotional, and I would put my hands up.
So how about those where the gastrographin does go through but they're not quite settling? Do they need nutritional support? Are we confident they're going to get better in a reasonable time frame within 5 days, I think was what you said was a reasonable time frame?
Yeah, so I think the data on gastrographin is pretty good for stratifying. So I would hope that most people will resolve on after a gastrographin challenge. If you're not seeing at least some flatus come through, the contrast has got through, you should get some flatus coming through. So if you're not seeing some flatus coming through within 24 hours or so, then I'm starting to ask myself questions about whether one, the underlying diagnosis was right, and two, is this someone who's just going to have a long haul problem? So if you have a positive gastrographin challenge, so someone passes the challenge but then doesn't really progress within 24-48 hours, yes, we'll talk to the nutrition team because they will have hit the 5 day mark by that point. But I'd also be thinking about re-imaging their abdomen to see what I'm missing.
Okay. So if let's say that they don't settle, but they've had gastrographin in the right colon, which does happen sometimes, how long should you leave that before you just intervene?
So I think, you're still looking at that 3 day mark. That's what the data says.
Right.
Gastrographin's a really nice thing because it can help you. One of the benefits of gastrographin is you can look at someone where you may not want to do an operation, perhaps they're a bit older or a bit frail, or you think their abdomen is going to be particularly hostile, very dense adhesions. And if they pass the gastrographin challenge, that can help get you out of potentially a difficult decision. But we've got to remember what the data shows overall is that 72 hours is your cutoff point for resolution and intervention. And it's going to be a small number who pass the gastrograph in but don't get better. And I think that that's where you have to really think about, does this person need an operation? And it will be on a case-by-case basis. Mm. Has their distension resolved? Is their pain getting better? Is their appetite starting to return, which might signal that it's just, you know, the distal gut that's not really woken up and whereas everything else is. So case-by-case, but with that 72-hour barrier in mind.
Okay. And how many will resolve by themselves?
So if we're talking about adhesive obstruction, two-thirds will resolve without surgical intervention. One-third needs surgery.
And that's the data,
That's the data from NASPRO. And what's really nice is it actually matches the historical data. Because I was taught all the way through medical school. That's not exactly historical. I'm not that old. But I don't think the teaching had changed that much, in the last 20, 30 years. So, you know, it's a third and two-thirds. And just while we're on, that point of things that haven't changed, the other thing that we keep revisiting is not letting the sun set on small bowel obstruction. The reason that keeps coming around is because it makes a really nice, provocative title for journals, and that's what we keep seeing. You can let the sun set on a small bowel obstruction. With our modern imaging techniques, but it's important. But I think that actually the sunset refers to the virgin abdomen who might have an internal hernia, or that group of people with ischemic findings on CT. They're the ones where we need to act. The other ones we've got a little bit of time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I was always taught never let the sunset on a virgin abdomen with small bowel obstruction.
Yeah.
And the others got drip and suck.
Thank you for listening to another podcast brought to you by School of Surgery. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook at School of Surgery, on iTunes, on Podomatic at schoolofsurgery.podomatic.com, and finally by searching School of Surgery on YouTube. Thank you very much, and see you next time.